are live. Me and Typo.
Nice. All right. Well, this is kind of, I don't really know how long it's been, but it's kind of been in the works for a little bit. Me and Sam talked about this a while ago, and it seemed some people were interested in it on my audience side and his audience side. So welcome. This is the first episode of A Gentleman and a Scholar book club. We decided to do a relatively short book, but kind of one that's what I think is interesting. It's The True History of the American Revolution by Sidney, what's his name? Sidney George Fisher. George
Fisher, and it's from 1902.
It's yes, sir. Yeah, it's not. It's actually not a very long book, so it's a pretty easy read. I think it's only like 5 or 6 chapters, to be honest. It's not very long at all. But this book, to me, I think the reason I chose it, because it just shines a light for a different perspective on the Revolutionary War that a lot of people aren't used to. And but before I get too ahead of myself, I just want to say, like, this is what the podcast, and this will be a little different from my Biting the Bullet and from me and Sam's other podcast, 5 to Midnight, a little bit more serious, probably not, you know, we'll still goof around, but a little bit more serious, little, less, comical, I guess would be the best way to put it.
Yeah. I mean, my podcast, Illegitimate Scholar, is pretty serious. That's kind of why I play such a goofball on 5 to Midnight. Goofball, what a dumb thing to say. But yeah, True History of the American Revolution, man. It's and obviously this, like anything else, is not meant to like supplant your own understanding of the American Revolution, but it's meant to like not to replace it, but to give a different perspective that we wouldn't always hear. So this is the one we're choosing. I think Typo started to read it already. I haven't yet. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to do this now. And then in 2 weeks, we're going to do the second half of the book. Then 2 weeks after that, or I'm sorry, the first half of the book. And then 2 weeks after that, we'll discuss the second half, and then we'll pick another book. What's up, JC and Enchiladas Unbreaded. Welcome, nice. Guys. So let's talk about it. Let's talk about this book that's kind of from the loyalist perspective.
Yeah, so that's kind of the main reason. So I picked this book. The main reason I picked it is because, you know, especially in the dissident right, you'll see a lot of revisionist history of the 20th century that seems very big right now. There's plenty of revisionist history you'll see for the Civil War. A lot of people that have different perspectives of the Civil War, especially if you're from the South itself. But this one is kind of like our unifying war. Like, this is like the war that literally brought this country and separated itself from the British. And, you know, there's a lot of people from even libertarian circles that I've came from that they kind of justify this war as like our only just war. And to me, you know, we've only ever heard the politics of our founding fathers and why they decided that they were, you know, their philosophy and why they thought they should be their own sovereign nation or nation states. And why, you know, the rebels' perspective in this war, and like, you know, it's just the evil British Empire was trying to raise taxes on the poor colonists and all the stuff that we grew up and we learned at least about in public school and all that. And this kind of what I think kind of broadens the perspective. The book goes a little bit into the French and Indian War, and which is kind of like the catalyst before the revolution even happened. It was a major war. I mean, it's called the French and Indian War here, but it's really called the 7 Years' War across Europe. And
the North American theater is called the French and Indian War. It's weird because they're like, the same war, but they're called different wars. And I they didn't really relate to each other a lot, but they were still like the colonial Americans fighting the colonial French. And it's called French and Indian because both sides, but more so the French, had a lot of native allies. And that that had some implications for the future. Quite a few implications. And it included the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, also called the Iroquois Confederacy, on the other side. And if you go back to some really older episodes, you'll find me talking about the significance of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy in the founding of the American country. And they played a real big role. But yeah, I think, so this goes into the French and Indian War.
I would say slightly, not too much, not too deep, but it kind of just lays the groundwork of, like, you know, the colonists were kind of okay with the British coming here and fighting off the French and Indians. And then, like, I don't remember the exact dates, but basically like a decade to 15 years later, all of a sudden they're like, hey, now that the French are gone and they're no longer a problem, we want to be our own country.
Yeah. So didn't really work out for them. It was very soon after. And George Washington was a colonel during the French and Indian War. Served. I'm sorry, I misspoke. The Iroquois Confederacy was on our side for this war, and so was the Wyandot. These are significant Native American tribes. I'm sure there were many others. But as you'll see here, under the commanders, we have George Washington on the British side, and the Wabanaki, another very important for early America Confederacy, the Wabanaki were the Confederacy. It's weird to say Algonquin because some of these other peoples are Algonquin, but yeah, I'm not going to get too much into the Native stuff. I'll lose myself, but
yeah, it's okay. The Shawnee, that's funny. I live around Shawnee National Forest.
Awesome. Very cool. So if you're just joining us, we're going to be reading this book, True History of the American Revolution. In 2 weeks, we're going to have a discussion. We might do a Twitter space on it. We might do it live. We're here to answer questions, discuss the book. And we'll be doing that in the Discord, the Illegitimate Scholar Discord, and if Typo wants to, in his own Discord as well. But yeah, here we are. You have anything else to say about this?
No, not really. Not really as a general summary or anything.
Yeah.
We can, if you want, we can just go ahead and get right into the preface.
Yeah. So you want to read the preface off, and I'll... While you read the preface, I'll bring up some images.
Okay, that sounds good.
Yeah, I actually bought the physical copy, but let me find a link to get it for free, right? Because it's, and you can buy a physical copy. Link is right below, or you can find it anywhere else. It's not expensive, but you can get it for free. I just don't like
it. It's on archive.org. It's an old book, so it's like, well, there's plenty of PDFs out there. I think recently, they did start
legally, even.
Yeah, that's what I meant. But before we even do that, I actually just wanted to talk about Sidney George Fisher himself. Actually, I forgot. I made some notes about that. Yeah, so Sidney George Fisher, he was just born in Philadelphia on September 11th, 1856. He's actually the son of a lawyer and historian, his father, who is Sidney George Fisher Sr. himself. He actually has a few books. I've never read them, but these two are actually relatively decently famous and respected historians for their time and in the 19th century, both of them. So he studied at St. Paul's School in New Hampshire. He graduated with a BA from Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut in 1879.
Where I was born.
Yeah. Studied at law at Harvard Law School for 2 years. He was a lawyer. That's what he did mainly most of his life. He was a lawyer in Philadelphia. And then he is famous for his most famous book is The True History of the American Revolution, published in 1902.
Oh, and The True Benjamin. He had a whole series of trues. The True Benjamin Franklin, The True William Penn.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, and gosh. Daniel Webster. And yeah, and then he passed away in February 22nd, 1927 at the age of 70 in Corinthian Yacht Club in Essington, Pennsylvania.
He passed away at a yacht club?
I guess so, dude.
That's funny.
He's a classy man. Yeah, he's got a nice mustache too.
He does. Check that out. Look at that mustache. Killer, early 20th century. That's a weird tie. It almost looks like hair.
Yeah, it does.
He died bawling out. Yeah, he sure did. All right, you want to read the preface?
Yeah, I'll move on. So it's only like 5 pages, but he just basically lays out why he wrote the book and what he tries to really nail in the head in it. But here we go. So the purpose of this history of the revolution is to use the original authorities rather more frankly than has been the practice within our historians. They appear to have taught it advisable to omit from their narrative a great deal which, to me, seems essential to a true picture. I cannot feel satisfied with any description of the revolution which treats the desire for independence as a sudden thought, and not a long growth and development, or which assumes that every detail of the conduct of the British government was absurdly stupid, even from its own point of view, and that the loyalists were a few in numbers and their arguments were not worth considering. I cannot see any advantage in not describing in their full meaning and force the smuggling, the buying of laws from the governor, and other irregular conduct in the colonies which led England to try to remodel them as soon as the fear of the French in Canada was removed. Nor can I accept a description which fails to reveal the salient details of a great controversy over the rather particular methods adopted by General Howe to suppress the rebellion. This controversy was part of the revolution and involved the interesting questions of Howe's instructions from the ministry and the methods which the ministry intended to use with the revolted colonists.
So I want to say something on this, on the topic of New England. Like, New England really was the center of the revolution in a lot of ways, Boston being the
capital of
the capital of Massachusetts, but essentially the capital of New England, although the colonies at that point were a little bit more separate, and I think at the time Massachusetts still controlled the territory of Maine. We still, in New England, sometimes call people from Maine North Massachusetts in a way to, you know, kind of piss them off because they don't like it. But for a long time, they had been able to rule themselves with these, what are they called? The charters. The different colonies had different charters. This is in stark contrast to New York, the colony of New York, which was a royal colony from the start, as it was taken from the Dutch. And actually, the Connecticut on its flag has an oak tree, which is called the Charter Oak. It's also the name of a credit union that is in Connecticut. It's the Charter Oak was an oak tree which the Connecticut rebels hid the Charter of Connecticut in, because the British tried to come in and just burn the charter and remove any piece of it so that they could instill governance over the New England colonies. And this is, you know, we talk about this from the perspective of the French and Indian War, which is in the 1750s, but the New England colonies had formed and had fought together and had a overarching, you know, almost federalistic government above these colonies as early as the 1630s. The There are various names for it. The New England Dominion, and which at some points included New York, but New York kind of falls out of it culturally. And they weren't included in these other wars. And the New England Confederation by the 1670s, which fought this annihilation war, King Philip's War, which to date is the deadliest war as a percentage of the population. What's up, Brent? Shout out, White Boy Summer Apparel. But yeah, so the New England colonies especially were already quite independent and had been for almost two centuries at that point. So it's no surprise that when that was the situation that they created and they ran with for so long, that when it comes time to change that situation, especially when they've been fighting for themselves with no help from the British, and then we help I say we because I'm from New England, but when the New England colonies then help the British in the French and Indian War, they're encouraged by their Iroquois allies, the Haudenosaunee, several years before that, to create their own country, just like the Iroquois had. But yeah, continue. Do you want to keep reading, or you want me to?
You can read a little bit. I stopped at okay. Whatever.
Yeah, I see it. Whatever we may now think of Howe's conduct, and this is the British general, and in whatever way we may try to explain it, the fact remains that it was once a subject which attracted universal attention and aroused most violent attacks upon him in England and among the loyalists in America. Some of these very plain-spoken arraignments, with evidence in support of them, can still be read in the writings of Galloway, Van Schaick, and others, or in Howe's own defense, which some thought was the strongest argument against him. Why should these documents and the evidence taken before the Parliamentary Committee of Inquiry be concealed from the ordinary reader, with the result that if by chance he turns to the original authorities, he is surprised to find that the revolution there described is entirely different from the one in which he had been taught to believe? This writing is very old style. Mm-hmm. I'm losing it a little bit. I'm not affiliated with WBS other than my online. I don't know why I thought you were affiliated with WBS, but yeah. Some of us might possibly not accept these attacks upon Howe as just or well-founded. They might think that his reply, which we can still read in his published narrative, was a complete defense and justification. There is no reason why we should not adopt any opinion or explanation which seems best. But I protest against the historians who refuse to give us a chance to form an opinion of our own on either the one side or the other. I protest against the concealing of this subject, of suppressing the whole of the evidence against Howe, as well as the evidence in his favor, and I protest because his conduct necessarily produced momentous results in the revolution. To my mind, the whole question of the conduct of General Howe is as important a part of history as the assistance rendered by France, for if what the people of his own time said of Howe be true, his conduct directly contributed to bring about our alliance with that country and ultimately our independence. I am personally a big fan of getting a full view of history from multiple different sources, even if one of those sources or many of those sources is deemed to be,
bias?
Well, yeah, bias. I mean, there's always bias, but like unsavory to the particular political, like, going against the ideas of the revolution of our founding is got to be unpopular. It's more popular today because it seems like everyone hates America, but it was very unpopular at the time. But I want to know what really happened, and I want to fit whatever. Like, there's always two sides to every story. There's always a lot.
Go ahead. I was just going to say that, yeah, I think that that's something like we never really, it's just like with all wars in America. I don't know if this is just an American thing. I'm sure there's bias for every nation, but it just seems that, you know, we're led to believe that it's these colonists were victims and were being taxed and suppressed by the British, and you know, I think one of the perfect examples was the Boston Massacre, where they make it out to be like this, you know, it was a riot, or not a riot, it was like these protesters against the British, the Redcoats, their soldiers. And I think even in reality, even from the American side at the time, like John Adams defended those Redcoats in court and got them acquitted of the charges, because it, yeah, what actually was happening, it was a riot and they were getting out of hand and they were throwing like rocks and stuff at these officers. And it was just like, okay, well, like, what do you, and like, you know, especially for the time. And
yelling at them to shoot them, by the way.
Yeah. And at the time, this was, that's how you shut down a riot. It was standard to like, and so they were actually being pretty resistant and not trying to hurt these people, but they just kept coming at them and throwing rocks at them and yelling at them. And so they did what they had to do. And then those guys were acquitted by our second president. So like, this is not just, but that story blew up across the colonies as like, this was a massacre by the British military on our, on the innocent colonists, and
fiery, but mostly so, peaceful anti-British protest.
Yeah. And that's what I think this book kind of gets at, is it just things that you thought were like, oh, this is obvious. Like they're trying to raise it even goes into the taxes thing, and whether you disagree with it or not, like, he lays a decent argument to why they thought they had the right to raise taxes. And it's not just because they wanted to siphon more money from the colonists because they thought they were their just bitches, essentially. They wanted to, I'll spoil the book a little, but a lot of it was going to the veterans that fought in the French and Indian Wars. A lot of it was the people that defended off the French and Indians from in the colonies were essentially going to have to pay for the cost of the war and the protection of their trading ships. So things like that you know, they just say taxes and they're just trying to tax the colonists. And, you know, I get it. Another thing too about this is a lot of the taxes that they did enforce were actually already in the books. They just weren't being heavily enforced by the crown itself. Their focus was other places, you know. And, you know, after the Seven Years' War, after the American, North American campaign, the French and Indian Wars, well, then once they're come to peace, they gave them time to like, okay, let's put a handle on these rowdy colonists.
I will say that there is one thing in that the colonists, because of the French and Indian War, number one, the war doesn't happen because of the colonies. It happens because of issues in mainland Europe. And that spills over.
Yes.
And the benefit to the colonists was essentially that they would be then allowed to go west where they wanted to go. They wanted to cross the Ohio River into Ohio Territory, which is much larger than just the state of Ohio, but the whole area west of the Appalachian Mountains. And the British wouldn't let them do that. So there was an element of like, yes, the British did send over troops to fight in the French and Indian War, but that war would not have affected the colonies if the British hadn't been starting crap in mainland Europe. And the English militia, or the colonial militias, of which George Washington and many other future statesmen fought in, not only were they have a human cost where they died fighting for this this largely colonial, or I'm sorry, continental conflict, but they also, the officers of the militia were like the colonel, George Washington, who was a 22-year-old colonel. This is very aristocratic type stuff. But the officers of the militia, the generals of the militia and all the officers were considered below a British regular private. And I don't know how much in actuality this created of issues between the colonists and the British, but that is a thing that occurred.
So I there's a book, it's called The Crucible of War, and it's all about the French and Indian War. And there's actually a serious contention between the officers from the colonies and officers from mainland England. So The big reason is because the officers in England are anointed by the king, where the officers in the under the colonies are anointed by the governors there. So the ones that come across the Atlantic from England, like, they have this entitlement, like, I'm anointed by the king, you're anointed by a governor, like, we are different levels of officer to them. And I can't remember his name specifically, but there is a captain that basically viewed himself as over George, Colonel George Washington. And he would get very frustrated in his letters, very frustrated when Washington would try to, like, direct him or tell him what to do. And he was like, I'm not listening to this guy. He's not a real officer type situation. And it's this funny little tension you see. But there is a lot of things, like the French and Indian War caused a lot of problems for the colonists and a lot of tension between the British military and the colonists. Actually, the French and Indian War is where I think we got our Third Amendment. Like, the idea of the Third Amendment came out of the French and Indian War, because how the British perspective was that they needed quarters for their men. And they didn't have the resources to build the quarters on the front lines in the Ohio Territory. So they started quartering themselves in civilian homes because they didn't.
And this happened in the American Revolution as well, but yes.
Yes, but it really sparked such a controversy with the colonists and British during the French and Indian War that I'm not good with these titles, but basically, like, the commanding general for the Ohio Territory, like, war, he got sent back to England because the colonists were getting ready to revolt at that time in that area because they were so frustrated about him quartering their troops. So I think that kind of gives, like, a little antidote where the Third Amendment came from.
These officers that were coming over, there's a huge, if you're not familiar with the politics of the military, I mean, even still today, me and Typo are both Marine veterans, the officers and the enlisted men are quite different from one another. And this was true at this point as well, but it was different because the enlisted men of their British army were essentially the dregs of the British society. This is like, it's not like the 20th century and 21st century militaries, where at least in the United States, the regular enlisted men are treated with a level of respect by the general populace. It wasn't a high status job. And these like dregs of English society coming over here and being quartered in the homes of the colonists is like they were causing a lot of issues, you know, and I don't know how common this was, but the treatment of women and the people hosting them
was a major issue. They would loot them too. Yeah. That was very common.
Yeah, because again, they were dregs of society. These are the same types of people who would have, you know, in a different circumstance, be just sent to Australia after this. Whereas in the United States was also sometimes used as a penal colony up until the American Revolution when they couldn't anymore.
Wow.
You want to keep reading? I got to grab something.
Yeah. So
at the bottom,
to my mind. Yeah. Okay. To my mind, the whole question of the conduct of General Howe is as important a part of history as the assistance rendered us by France. For if what the people of his own time said of Howe be true, his conduct directly contributed to bring about our alliance with that country and ultimately our independence. There has, it seems, been a strong temptation to withhold from the modern public a knowledge of the controversy over Howe's conduct because it is impossible to disclose the controversy in all its bearings without at the same time showing that the British government up to the summer of 1778 used extremely lenient and concessory methods in dealing with the revolted colonists. The historians appear to have felt that to admit that such gentle methods were used would be inadvisable. would tend to weaken our side of the argument and show that we were bent on independence for mere independence's sake. The historians seem to have assumed that we do not want to know about the controversy, or that it will be better for us to not know about it. They have assumed that it will be better for Americans to think that the independence was a sudden and deplorable necessity and not a desire of a long and ardent growth and cautiously planned intention. Dude, this is hard to read sometimes.
It is hard to read. That's why we're doing it together.
He adds so many words into a sentence and just instead of ending the sentence.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was normal. Okay. So they have assumed that we want to think of England as having lost the colonies by failure to the consolatory. You changed my page.
I lost the spot.
I hate you.
Well, consolatory. I was crying.
No, where you're fine. They have assumed that we want to think of England as having lost the colonies by a failure to be conciliatory, and that the revolution was a one-sided smooth affair without any of the difficulties or terrors of a rebellion or a great upheaval of settled opinions. The taint of these assumptions runs through all of our histories. They are, I think, mistaken assumptions and an affront to our people. They prefer to know the truth and the whole truth, and there is nothing in the truth of which they need to be afraid.
He's a great writer, but this is from the time where they didn't really, and this still happens in academic papers today. It's great because it gives me a job, but they don't make it very easy to understand what they're saying. They just try to, it's so annoying to overcomplicate things like this. Although I assume this was more common at the time, a way of speaking.
I imagine so.
You want me to keep going?
I'll finish this paragraph here. Having decided to withhold from the public a knowledge of the contemporary opinion of how the historians naturally conceal or obscure this relation to the Whig Party. The position of that party in England is its connection with the rebel colonists, the particular difficulties under which the Tory ministry labored, and their instructions to Howe. You just changed the page on me.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know you were reading off of this.
Yeah, once I saw you had it up, I started reading off yours. Where was I? Oh, Howe on the conduct of war. Unless all of these conditions are clearly set forth, most of the events and battles of the revolution are inexplicable.
I have no idea what this guy's talking about.
I think he's basically defending General Howe's conduct up until 1778.
Hmm. Was this General Howe, I feel like, was in the...
I think he's in the movie, The Patriot.
The Patriot, yeah.
Yeah, I think he's the guy at the end. Or he's throughout the movie. At the end...
Maybe not.
I think he's the one that signs the... he surrenders at Virginia, I believe.
William Howe, this guy. I love The Patriot.
It is a great movie.
I don't think this is General Howe. This is the other guy.
I don't think that guy's real.
No, I don't think so. A lot of that movie isn't real, but it's awesome. I love Mel Gibson. but this is the guy we're talking about. He fought in the Battle of Bunker Hill, which was a Pyrrhic victory. I think for the British. Okay. Before I discovered the omissions of our standard histories, I always felt as though I were reading about something that had never happened, and that was contrary to the ordinary experience of human nature. I could not understand how a movement which was supposed to have had such a deep uprooting of settled thought and custom, a movement which is supposed to have been one of the great epochs of history, could have happened like an occurrence in a fairy tale. I could not understand the military operations, and it seems strange to me that they were not investigated, explained, and criticized like those of Napoleon's campaign or of our own Civil War. Right, so this is pretty common in a situation like this where, like, it's pretty agreed upon by basically everybody, at least in the important positions, that a certain side was correct, or at least acting in like, the taking their side is good for everybody. Whereas the American Civil War, after a while, you get into Reconstruction and rehabilitation or reconciliation between the North and the South. And this isn't true anymore at great cost, I think, to the nation itself, but of, you know, understanding the other side's reasons for doing what they did. But in the case of the American Revolution, or in a situation like Napoleon's campaigns in Europe, which are of no consequence to us because it didn't really matter besides just the general Anglo bias and maybe some bias in on the other side in favor of Napoleon, as Napoleon is an offshoot of the French Revolution itself, an offshoot of our own spiritual, you know, the created narrative. Whereas I would generally call the American Revolution, trying to be as least biased as possible, as not really a revolution, but more like a civil war in the sense that it was in the aristocracy in the United States, what became the United States, versus the aristocracy in England, whereas the Civil War was more like, the American Civil War was more like a revolution in the sense that while, yes, it was aristocratic in nature, it was one side trying to split from the other.
I think the War of 1812, Paul, probably plays a part in that, to where, you know, they still see the British as an adversary, an enemy, you know, decades later. So I think that adds the fuel of, like, and I think there's also like this incentive that even if you, like, say you were for staying under the British Empire, and Bolden, the colonists ended up seceding and declaring their independence, a lot of people probably just switch sides or just like, okay, I guess I'm okay with this now, because you don't want to be seen as the guy, like, I mean, I think the book will get into it, but the treatment of loyalist was not particularly the best. But
yeah.
But I think there's just a lot of factors that play, and this war is like, this essentially became our nation's identity. So we have to like, what's the word? We have to save or keep that identity going, or it's like, what's the point? Why'd we even do this type thing? And I think their identity is like, we defeated, you know, at the time the biggest in military in power and became our own nation. And that's, you know, it's a very, I mean, hell, it still goes on to this day. There are people that when they talk about the revolution, it's from the colonists and maybe even liberal, classical liberal perspective. And I think that that story, whether it's mostly fairy tale or somewhat fairy tale or whatever, however you want to say it.
Yeah, it's a founding myth, which doesn't mean there's not truth in it, but it is constructed as not a historical event, really, but as a, it's... because of the bias inherent in it, like what I was talking about before, it's certain things have to be concentrated on based on that bias, because it is the founding myth of the country, and things fall apart if that's not shared. It's a cosmology in a sense.
Excuse me. The way I agree. Where, I don't even know where you right here. Left off at. Oh, do you want to keep reading?
I'll keep going. I was never satisfied until I had spent a great deal of time in research, burrowing into the dust of the hundreds of old brown pamphlets, newspapers, letters, personal memoirs, documents, publications of historical societies, and the interminable debates of Parliament, which, now that the eyewitnesses are dead, constitute all the evidence that is left us of the story of the revolution. Those musty documents painted a very vivid picture upon my mind, and I wish I had the power of painting the picture as the original sources reveal it. I understand, of course, that the methods used by our historians have been intended to be productive of good results, to build up nationality, that's key, and check sectionalism, which is also key, and rebellion, because like we think of the United States as very connected today. And often in history, there's talk of the country, the federal government being much more powerful after the American Civil War. But the identity of these separate colonies, you know, in different groups, if you look at one of those original like propaganda posters from the American Revolution, New England, like on that snake, I'll pull it up in a second, but on that snake where it says like divided, we fall, united, whatever, New England is really considered one thing. And that's because the New England colonies had a prior history of being their own organization together. Between those colonies, but those like there was battles between the colonies both before and as states after the American Revolution, skirmishes more like, but they were fighting each other, and join or die. That's what it is, JC. Thank you. And they were together only like out of necessity, and they needed to create a narrative that continued to push people together up to and after, especially the American Civil War.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, under the Articles of Confederation, I mean, there was a lot of, it was pretty disorganized. You know, there was no central authority really. Every colony was its own state essentially, and they were creating their own currency, and there was a bunch of, it wasn't really coming together. Things were kind of falling apart. And while things were falling apart, there was a revolution happening in France that was, you know, kind of freaked the founding fathers out. So I don't know exactly if it was coordinated, but I think it was kind of something that came together where we need to create an identity for this country. And yeah, I think that's what he kind of points out, what you kind of just described. And I think that's probably why this story of the revolution kind of gets, you know, a lot of people just buy into it. They don't like really look into the myth. And I mean, hell, dude, I mean, my grandparents, there's people today that still kind of like, you know, we need another 1775, you know, and like they're always referencing this revolution.
Yeah.
We'll see. That's cool.
Yeah, New England is there as its own thing. And then all the other states are separate. But yeah, join or die. And this was because they had to push the idea that the country was together, especially when they have very separate beginnings. They were never intended to be one country at their beginning. They were, you know, Puritans up in the Northeast versus is that a Charles C. Mann book? Colin Woodard. But this is another book that talks about these origins. This is a book that I recommend quite a bit. Go in here, Yankeedom up here. It includes upstate New York, but that's because the colonists that settled upstate New York as well as into the Midwest were from New England, whereas these other places were settled by different people. Tidewater includes aristocrats from a certain area of England, the Deep South, a different, New France being Louisiana, and then parts of it up here in what's now Quebec. But yeah, there's a lot going on here, and I think this is a good first book to choose. So read along with us. If you're joining us again, you didn't hear, we're going to be reading this book 2 weeks. We're going to do another one on live on the Illegitimate Scholar channel, and this is going to be put up on the Biting the Bullet feed. And then after that, we'll 2 weeks after that, we're going to do the second half of the book. Did I say that right?
Yes, you did.
These musty documents painted a very vivid picture upon my mind, and I wish I had the power of painting the picture as the original sources reveal it. I understand, of course, that the methods used by our historians have intended to be productive of good results to build up nationality and to check sectionalism and rebellion. Students in the literary class do not altogether like successful rebellions, and the word revolution is merely another name for a successful rebellion. That is a very insightful point. I talk about this a lot. The book is free. If you want a physical copy, there's a link to the Amazon page below. I think it's only $9. I bought it, but the book can be found for free below, not illegal because it's out of, it's from 130 years ago. Rebellions are a trifle awkward when you have settled down, although the Declaration of Independence contains a clause to relieve this embarrassment by declaring that governments long established should not be changed for light or transient causes. The people who, they're probably trying to, with that line, like being like, you know what? This is the last one. This is the last one we're going to do. Like, we're going to do it, but don't do it again. The people who write histories are usually of the class who take the side of the government in a revolution. And as Americans, they are anxious to believe that our revolution was different from others. Yeah, anxious to believe that our revolution was different from others, to separate it from these others. More decorous, I guess that comes from decorum, and altogether free from atrocities, mistakes, and absurdities which characterize even the Patriot Party in a revolution. They do not like to describe in their full coloring the strong Americanism and the doctrines of the rights of man which inspired the party that put through our successful rebellion. They have accordingly tried to describe a revolution in which all scholarly, refined, and conservative persons might have unhesitantly taken part, but such revolutions have never been known to happen. This is a great preface, man. It really is.
Yeah, I that's why when I started reading it and I was like, okay, we should just read this on air because he gives a little insight where I think he's right when he, I mean, maybe this is true about other countries as well. I'm not sure. I'm sure it is. But Americans look at our revolution as different and they think it's like we're the best one. We did it the right way and there's no problems along the way. And that's just historically speaking, it's just not true of any revolution ever in history, even the American one.
Yeah. You want to read the rest?
Yeah, for sure. So the revolution was a much more ugly and unpleasant affair than most of us imagine. I know of many people who talk a great deal about their ancestors, but who I am quite sure would not now take the side of their ancestors chose. Nor was it a great, spontaneous, unanimous uprising, all righteousness, perfection, and
infallibility.
Infallibility, a marvel of success at every step and incapable of failure, as many of us very naturally believe from what we have read. The device of softening the unpleasant or rebellious features of the revolution does not, I think, accomplish the improving and edifying results among us, which the historians from their exalted situation are so gracious as to wish to bestow. A candid and free disclosure of all that records contain would be more appreciated by our people and of more advantage to them. They are a fully competent to judge of the actions and events as any one of their number who takes upon himself the task of the historian. It will be observed that I invariably speak of those colonists who were opposed to the rebellion as loyalists and not as Tories. They never fully accepted the name Tory, either in its contemptuous sense or as a meaning a member, a meaning a Okay, a member of the Tory Party of England that were not entirely in accord with that party. They regarded themselves as Americans who were loyal to what they called the Empire, and this distinction was, in their minds, of vast importance. I have labored to describe them strictly from their own point of view, which the arguments, facts, principles, and feelings which they used in their pamphlets and documents, and I give them the name which they preferred. They were far more numerous than it is generally supposed. And on the difficult question of their numbers, I shall give my readers the advantage of all that I can find in the records. In the illustrations of this volume, I have, for the most part, avoided reproduction of portraits because they are apt to be misleading. I have given, however, the portraits of two loyalists whose fine clothes do not perhaps misrepresent them. We can have faith in very few of the revolutionary portraits as likeness, and the handsome clothes of or magnificent uniforms in which it was easy enough to paint patriot officers, and the modern illustrator's efforts to produce
quaintness
are all together inconsistent with the
agitation, ragged poverty, suffering, and apparent hopelessness, which marked one of the most remarkable political outbursts in history. I think you're just losing it a little bit because of the loss of the loss of the resolution through the streaming. But yeah,
yeah, so that, this that didn't help, but I'm also dumb.
Oh, this is going to be from the loyalist perspective. So we're going to read, let's see, what's half of this? 404 Cornwallis. So it's, the history seems to be mostly chronological. We'll read up to, we'll read up to seven, up to chapter seven in this version of the book, Triumphant Toryism. And we'll get through that for the first 2 weeks. So follow along with us and find us here doing another live stream 2 weeks from today. And then 2 weeks after that, we'll do the other half of the book. And we'll talk about it here, and we can talk about it in the Discord, which is linked below, the Illegitimate Scholar Discord. And I hope you guys will read this, follow along with us, and give your thoughts on it, as well as, you know, other information and figures and maps and whatever is involved in this, which I will be putting in the Discord. So join that.
Yeah, that, yeah, it's a free book too. I even think there, if you're not into reading, there's even an audiobook version on YouTube. I think it's an AI voice that reads it. But if you want to listen to the Audible or audio version, you can do that as well. But it's a pretty easy read. Just gives you a little bit of a insight into the other perspective. I think it'll be a lot of fun to talk about. And yeah, I hope you guys are interested in it and join the Discord. And I'll have to join Sam's Discord. I don't think I'm even in it.
Yeah. I think I'm actually more, I'm also more active in your Discord than you are in your own Discord, which is fine. I mean, they don't need to be for you to participate in, but I'm in that.
Yeah.
All right, guys, any questions before we sign off here in the comments? I think we want to do a space on this as well to give you guys a chance to give your thoughts, but I'm looking forward to this, looking forward to the book club, have been for a while. It's been heavily requested by both of our audiences. And I'm glad to be doing this with Typo, the least stupid member of Five Till Midnight. The other three guys besides me are dumb as hell. Oh, I'm sorry. I said sure. I said seven, but I meant 12. I just read it wrong. It's like I'm dumb.
Yeah, I can't read Roman numerals. I'll be honest.
Does the gentleman have an X handle? Yes, it's at the real Typo. And I screwed that up earlier and tagged some random guy.
that was hilarious.
Just Typo at Typo. Yeah, he does. I'm gonna share it below. Real Typo, and I'll send this file to you in an MP3 so you can put it on the Biting the Bullet.
Cool.
And yeah, if there's no other questions, I guess you got anything else to say before we sign off here?
No, just look forward to hopefully seeing you guys contribute to this, because that'll be really cool to either you guys to follow along and probably point out stuff that me and Sam miss, or if you guys have interesting thoughts or perspectives from other books or something, you guys can let us know, because that would be fun to add into this. But no, that's all I got. Thanks for joining.
All right. Thanks a lot for coming, everybody.